Texas offers one of the biggest delegate prizes in all the U.S. Are Democrats in this year's presidential contest taking it seriously enough? We'll explore today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown in the Texas Standard Newsroom. A closer look at how far the candidates are going to win over Texas voters and what's at stake. Also, as candidates focus their energies on places like Iowa, should Texas consider taking a stand as the state with the first primary in the nation? Plus, a state historic site reopens after devastating tornadoes, a return to the Caddo Mounds, plus a whole lot more as the national news show of You Know Where gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 14th day of January 2020. I'm David Brown, and it is great to have you with us. What's making news in your part of Texas? Tweet us right now, won't you? Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar, our social media editor, will be joining us with some of your comments in just a few minutes. Well, you know, when it comes to the quadrennial presidential race, it is the big kahuna, the ne plus ultra, the king of the hill, top of the heap. Yes, in other words, what many of us might call Texas. But in politics, well, it depends on who's counting. On Super Tuesday, the Lone Star State has the largest Democratic Party delegate count after California. The real question here is how big of a prize Democrats in this year's contest consider Texas to be. Abby Livingston has been pondering such matters. She is Washington Bureau Chief for the Texas Tribune, and she joins us now. Abby, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So a presidential candidate could win the most votes in the state, but not necessarily the most delegates. Could you explain how that works, actually?
So candidates will campaign in the state, and a Democratic operative, national one, who doesn't live in Texas, was the one who pointed this out to me. We could be watching cable news that night, and it'll say, candidate X won Texas. Mm-hmm. And you're going to sit there and think, oh, they got all these delegates. That's not the case. That meant they got the most votes. But what's going to happen is the votes will be divided up by state Senate district, and there are 31 of them in the state. And the delegates within those districts vary based on how Democratic that district voted in the 2018 primary. And to even be eligible to win delegates in that contest, you will need to get at least a 15% threshold. So you can't really walk away with 10% of the delegates. There will be another phase of that statewide. Again, you got to get 15%. And so it's a very complex thing. I am still trying to master this. If we have a brokered convention next summer, my brain will explode.
Yeah. But just to be clear, if my civics classes, my recollection of civics is correct, these were the rules that the Democrats themselves came up with, right? I mean, it's not Republicans trying to rig things on the Democratic side.
Not at all. This is done by elected Democratic officials, like within the party, not necessarily office holders. And so this is how they wanted it. It's going to be complex, but it's going to be a very fascinating thing to watch.
All right. But Texas, behind California, has the largest delegate count on Super Tuesday, which, of course, raises the question, you know, most folks, I think, presume they know where California is headed. It's largely certainly a big state for Democrats right now. How big of a prize is Texas for Democratic presidential candidates in the primaries and for that matter beyond?
So it's 228 delegates, and I don't have the numbers from the other states in front of me, but I mean, this is daunting compared to what Iowa and New Hampshire are going to deliver to a candidate. But what's different is, as we all know, Iowa, New Hampshire, those states, they give a candidate, if they do well there, jet fuel within the media, free media coverage, momentum. And so when I looked at the calendar, you know, I will confess to a bias, I care about Texas. And my blood ran cold when I realized that the South Carolina primary is on the Saturday before the Texas primary. And I just had this concern that presidential candidates would look up and go, oh, on that Saturday, we've got Texas 3 days from now. That has not appeared to be the case. Texas will be relevant in this one. It appears candidates are coming in. And so it's going to be a really a fascinating thing to watch as they balance all of these priorities in all of these other states.
Yeah, in fact, we've been talking about how New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg did a little bus tour in Texas over the weekend. Pete Buttigieg making stops in Texas last week. What about Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders? Are they just looking to national name recognition, or are they going to try to put down some stakes here and try to claim the top prize for the Democrats here in Texas?
They're not ignoring Texas. Now, I'll be clear, these trips are usually paired with Texas's conventional role in the Democratic primary, which is fundraising. So they'll hit up fundraisers and then go do public events. But Joe Biden has a very well-regarded state director in Dallas. Elizabeth Warren, bar none, has the most biggest operation. I don't quite have a sense on Bloomberg's, but for months, Elizabeth Warren has been hiring staff and building up her campaign. So I think it'll be a daunting effort, but Joe Biden's name ID is going to be formidable, and I anticipate.
Abby Livingston is Washington Bureau Chief for the Texas Tribune. We'll link to her latest at texasstandard.org. Abby, great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a rough couple of days for Houston sports fans. On Sunday, the Texans went from leading 21-0 at the end of the first quarter in their game with the Kansas City Chiefs to lose that AFC divisional round game by a final of 51-31. So much for the Super Bowl. But there's always baseball, right? Well, there's also this. On Monday afternoon, news broke that Major League Baseball's investigation into cheating allegations against the Houston Astros had concluded with a finding that Astros management used electronically assisted sign-stealing techniques during the team's 2017 World Series winning season and partially throughout 2018. The league imposed what has been described as the most severe penalties in Major League Baseball history, and the fallout doesn't stop there either. Chandler Rome is Astros beat writer at the Houston Chronicle. Chandler, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard.
Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, before we get to the allegations, let's talk about these penalties. The most serious in MLB history, what does it include?
So the penalties that Major League Baseball levied were a year suspension for general manager Jeff Luhnow, a year suspension for manager A.J. Hinch, a $5 million fine, which is the most that Major League Baseball is allowed to fine clubs according to the Constitution, and the Astros have to forfeit their first and second round draft picks in 2020 and 2021. However, Astros owner Jim Crane took that to another level when he met with the media an hour later, deciding to terminate both A.J. Hinch and Jeff Luhnow. And it was a pretty seismic move for the Astros organization, considering Jeff Luhnow is the man who resurrected this franchise from being an also-ran in the early 2010s. He was widely considered one of the best general managers, not only in baseball, but in all of sports. Constantly atop the list of top executives, and a guy that was integral to getting the Astros back into their glory days. And then the same can be said for Astros manager A.J. Hinch. He departs as the second winningest manager in franchise history.
Yeah.
He oversaw two pennant wins, three playoff appearances, widely considered throughout the game to be one of the best managers in baseball. And then both he and Jeff Luhnow are now unemployed.
So just what exactly were these allegations involving? I mean, I read electronically assisted. What's the significance of that?
So here's what Major League Baseball concluded the Astros did. During the 2017 season, when they won the World Series, and part of the 2018 season, they used a camera that was situated in center field to zoom in on opposing catchers' signs. They would get the signs in the dugout via a live feed on a monitor inside the dugout, and then they would relay what pitch was coming to batters on the field by banging a trash can once for a fastball, twice for a breaking ball. They would have a coordinated effort there as to, and it changed every game. And then that way that the Astros players were able to know what pitch was coming a couple of seconds before it was thrown. And I think it's important to note that Major League Baseball's investigation found that Jeff Luhnow did not know this was going on, and manager A.J. Hinch did not order this to happen, nor did he condone it. But the problem that Major League Baseball had and the problem that Jim Crane ultimately had was both of these guys, while they didn't condone it and while they didn't order it to happen, they didn't do anything to stop it.
Yeah, well, there's that. But there's also the fact that, okay, $5 million is being made out like this is a huge deal. And I know it's limited by the MLB Constitution, but that's pocket change for a lot of these owners. And this all came off with such, I mean, it seems so smooth. A lot of people sort of wondering whether or not there isn't a sort of a, I don't know, whether or not there's a kind of incentive for this cheating because the penalty is so low. And you take a look at the valuation of a team like the Astros after their world championship. They're now like, what, $1.8 billion in valuation?
I'll put it to you this way. If you were owner Jim Crane, would you trade what happened yesterday, having to fire your manager and general manager, for what has happened the past 6 years? Three playoff appearances, a World Series title that is not going to be taken away. Major League Baseball is not going to vacate the Astros title.
Yeah.
And you just mentioned all the revenues that come with it, all the higher prestige, you know, having your name and your brand accentuated and being a lot better. That's a question that a lot of owners and a lot of general managers have to ask themselves now. Is the cheating worth it, even with the penalties that happened today? There are some people in baseball that feel yes. I mean, while the penalties that were levied seem so harsh and so egregious, there is still a prevailing thought in the industry that not enough was done to the Astros to dissuade this from happening again.
Chandler Rome is Astros beat writer at the Houston Chronicle. No doubt the fallout will continue. Chandler, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Oh, thank you.
Boy, I'd love to know what Texans are thinking about that story. What are you seeing out there, Wells Dunbar, social media editor?
Well, quite astute prediction there, David. Our friends and listeners sounding off about the story we just heard, this reversal of fortune for the Houston Astros. On our Facebook page, Ed Scruggs says, almost every Astro knew the cheating was taking place and said nothing. They are all complicit. It doesn't matter if other teams did it. It was still wrong. They cheated the game and the fans. Robert Franks says that they should take the Astros World Series championship and a trophy. However, Daniel Ellis, he makes a cross-sports comparison. If Tom Brady gets to keep his Super Bowl rings, the same applies here. A little shade thrown at the Patriots there. Hmm. But interesting to compare and contrast the sort of cheating scandal there with this and the sort of hammer, you could say, that got brought down. Well, speaking of showdowns, going into tonight's Democratic debate, Elizabeth Warren says Bernie Sanders told her in 2018 that a woman couldn't win the presidency. Sanders, currently leading in Iowa polling, denies having said so. We're hearing from plenty of folks about the apparent end of the non-aggression pact between these two progressives. I will be back with reactions on that later.
I wonder if that's going to come up tonight, huh?
Probably so.
I'm thinking it might. Time to order pizza? Or I don't know. Hey, listen, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know what's on your news radar. As always, just look for Texas Standard. You know who's looking for you. Wells Dunbar will be joining us once again in about 35 minutes or so here on The Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. A new billboard that went up this month in Dallas, which features a woman wearing the traditional hijab or head covering scarf, also includes an 1-800 number and the words respect, honor, and strength. The groups behind this billboard and similar ones in Houston and Chicago say they are designed to encourage dialogue on the fundamental teachings of Islam and to make the case for the hijab as a sign of empowerment. KERA's Galilee Abdullah reports.
The billboard on Interstate 45, southeast of downtown Dallas, features the message, Find Jesus in the Quran, Muhammad in the Bible. The Muslim Jesus campaign was launched by a Chicago-based group called Gain Peace. It does community outreach for the Islamic Circle of North America. The goal of the billboard? To let the public know that just like in Christianity, Jesus is also a part of Islam. Sabil Ahmed is the executive director of Gain Peace.
To let our friends and brothers and sisters of other faith know that they may have misconceptions that Muslims don't believe in Jesus and the Virgin Mary. So Jesus is mentioned with love and respect and honor more than 25 times in the Quran. And Mary, the mother of Jesus, is likewise mentioned 32 times in the Quran.
The same billboard is on display in Houston, Chicago, and Atlanta. The billboard's also designed to spark dialogue. It says, "Free Quran, discuss Islam," and it features a phone number, 1-800-662-ISLAM. Ahmed says these billboard campaigns have brought in thousands of calls over the years.
We have received close to 60,000 calls in the last 10 years. People call us, they ask us questions, and we also have a service where we send them free copy of the Quran, either in English or in Spanish.
Ahmed says he hopes the billboard campaign will help people realize that Islam stands for justice and peace. I'm Galilee Abdullah in Dallas.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Dear President Trump, would you please issue a disaster declaration for some tornadoes that tore up part of Texas back in October? That's the essence of a letter sent from Governor Greg Abbott to the White House, although done with considerably more formality. Now, it is not unusual for disaster declarations to precede known serious weather events or to come in the immediate aftermath of devastation. This request, coming several months later, suggests there might be more to the story. And there is. Jesus Jimenez has been covering it for the Dallas Morning News. Jesus, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So Governor Greg Abbott is asking the federal government to do what? Send some money or just make this disaster declaration?
So both in a way. So Governor Abbott sent the letter to President Trump yesterday, Monday, asking him to issue a presidential disaster declaration. Now, that declaration is needed to be able to release federal funds to, in this case, it would be Cameron, Erath, and Dallas counties. And this is all in response to severe weather that rolled through the area October 20th of last year. Dallas was, I think, hit the hardest. It had an EF1 tornado.
Mm-hmm.
And so if this declaration is issued by President Trump, then those three counties, including Dallas, would be eligible to receive these funds.
I have to say that I'm a little struck by the timing of this. I mean, first of all, you have a presidential visit coming this weekend. We are in a presidential year. This comes several months after the fact. Is it unusual for a request for a disaster declaration to be made several months after an event, or is it just, does it take that long to determine how much it's going to cost to rebuild?
It is a bit unusual. Like you said, it's not uncommon to see it right before. Like if there's a hurricane on in the way and we know it's going to be pretty devastating, or immediately after. The issue here, though, is largely in part the fact that so immediately after the tornadoes, FEMA came out to all the counties affected and started surveying to see how much to get estimates on how much these storms would cost. And so FEMA has said that Dallas County specifically falls short of the threshold for the damage cost necessary for a presidential disaster declaration. So FEMA would essentially recommend to President Trump to issue that. And so in a way here, because FEMA has not done that, because FEMA says that Dallas falls short, Abbott is asking Trump directly to issue that instead of waiting on FEMA to issue that recommendation.
What about funds from the state? Or is it that there's not enough, or is it that there's no way to access those funds, or what?
I think it's probably a little bit of both, maybe more of the first one. In his letter, Abbott mentions that, the October tornadoes are just one thing that the state is dealing with. He mentions that the state's still dealing with, recovery from Hurricane Harvey efforts, as well as, flooding and droughts and other, tropical storm Imelda as well. And so it's just one of several severe storm systems, climate disasters that have affected the state over the past 5 to 10 years, and all of these events have been costly, and so that's why Abbott is seeking federal funds now, going beyond just the state funds.
So this would free up funds in South, Central, and North Texas, Dallas counties. But I want to be sure I understand this. What about rebuilding efforts thus far? I mean, where have these communities been getting resources to try to bounce back?
So in Dallas specifically, there are some funds that Dallas has been tapping into, but not a lot has been done. I live here in Dallas, and you can drive up Central Expressway 75 and the Dallas North Tollway, and there's still so many houses that have been damaged, infrastructure that's been damaged, just kind of sitting there waiting. There's, you know, entire buildings. There's a Home Depot that was completely demolished, and it's just kind of just sitting there right now. There's even some businesses that I know, one in particular in the Preston Hollow area here in Dallas, which was affected pretty seriously. It's opening this Friday. And so it's just been sitting there for the past few months. And so there's been some funds that the city has been able to, and the county have been able to access, but it is taking a while to tap into other funds.
Do you have a sense of whether families were affected here, or are we talking about businesses that were that were hardest hit, or what is your sense of what the situation has been like for those who's been most affected, I suppose?
I would say probably businesses. The Preston Hollow area, I was driving the night after, or immediately after the tornado, driving around that area, and it was essentially ground zero. You could not drive around anywhere, and some businesses had to move altogether. Some businesses will have to rebuild entirely. Others were lucky and, you know, had to close for a couple of months, but are able to reopen without any serious damage. As far as families, it did hit a area where, you know, Preston Hollow is a pretty affluent area, and so a lot of families are able to rebuild pretty quickly, as opposed to have had it hit, you know, South Dallas, where, you know, income levels aren't as high, and maybe people don't have, you know, insurance on their homes. And so I would say definitely businesses have been kind of hit the hardest by these storms, at least in Dallas County.
Jesus Jimenez has been covering this story for the Dallas Morning News, and we're going to have a link to his latest over at texasstandard.org, so read all about it there. Jesus, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard. Keep us posted on how this goes forward, would you?
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Hey, we're not done talking tornadoes, although they might be done with the aftermath of a tornado out in East Texas at a very important state historic site, which has been closed down for many, many months. Our own Michael Marks went out to check out what was actually going down, and we're going to be hearing from him right after the Texas Roundup, and that's coming up in just a couple of minutes here on The Standard. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a network of more than 460 physicians who deliver cancer-fighting treatments and compassionate care to more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The National Weather Service is surveying wind damage in North Texas to tell if any more tornadoes touch down amid Friday's outbreak of severe thunderstorms. 8 twisters have been confirmed across the state, including 2 in the Dallas area and 5 in East Texas. Another tornado touched down near College Station. National Weather Service hydrologist C.S. Ross is based in Shreveport, Louisiana, and says the damage in East Texas was relatively minor despite winds up to 100 miles per hour.
Numerous trees, power lines down, tree limbs, roof damage, especially to metal roofs, minor damage to homes, roof damage to homes. That's the type of damage we surveyed.
Surveyors today are assessing if a tornado touched down in Irving as well. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement is soliciting contracts for 3 detention centers in Texas, but 10 of the 13 Texas Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives are calling for the process to be suspended. TPR's Lauren Terrazas has more on a letter they sent to federal officials Monday.
The lawmakers criticized the 3 facilities seeking 10-year contracts for immigrant detention sites, the South Texas Detention Complex in Pearsall, the T. Don Hutto Residential Center in Taylor, and the Houston Processing Center. They say all 3 sites are known to have facilitated family separations. There are also allegations of mistreatment and abuse at the facilities, including deaths and reports of sexual assault. The Congress members are seeking additional information about the contracts issued by ICE. They argue the lack of oversight creates opportunity for the abuse and mistreatment of migrants. I'm Lauren Terrazas in San Antonio.
And the 3 Democratic members of Congress from Texas who did not sign on to the letter are Lizzie Fletcher of Houston, Henry Cuellar of Laredo, and Eddie Bernice Johnson of Dallas. A U.S. House subcommittee is holding a hearing on how states are working to address the opioid crisis. One of the panel members is Texas Republican Michael Burgess. This morning, the congressman from Louisville thanked the witnesses for helping to identify challenges in fighting the ongoing epidemic.
While ensuring that patients can manage their pain, it is important to Congress to have hearings like this where we can ensure the effectiveness of legislative efforts and identify gaps where they exist.
In 2017 alone, more than 47,000 people died due to drug overdose involving opioids in the United States. Texas accounted for 1,458 of those deaths. And the Baylor Bears and Texas Longhorns have made the cut for the Associated Press's Top 25 College Football Poll. Baylor placed 13th in the national ranking based on last year's season, where the team had an 11-3 record. Texas took last place on the list due in part to a strong New Year's Eve performance at the Alamo Bowl. I'm Joseph Leahy.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. In East Texas, there is a site sacred to some of Texas's earliest settlers, a place that is an important touchstone of Texas history. They are earthen mounds, a triptych of grassy undulations about 30 miles west of Nacogdoches, where the Caddo people once lived for centuries. Most would later relocate to what is modern-day Oklahoma. Well, last April, during a cultural celebration there, a tornado ripped through the place now called the Caddo Mounds State Historic Site, leaving such devastation it was closed down, off-limits to the public. That is, until Saturday. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks was there.
Looking to the southwest, you can see a good distance from the porch of the temporary visitor center at Caddo Mounds State Historic Site, all the way to a forested ridge a few miles off. You couldn't always see that far, but you can now.
We were kind of isolated in this pine bowl, if you will, you know, with the tall trees all around us and then this prairie here, but with the pines gone, it looks so different.
That's Jeffrey Williams, president of the Friends of Caddo Mounds. The mounds for which the site is named served various purposes, including burials and religious ceremonies. Unlike nearby trees and buildings, they were untouched by last April's tornado.
Like I said, you know, when I pulled myself up out of the mud, one of the first things I saw were the mounds were still there. But it's an enduring sacredness that persists.
The tornado hit during the site's annual Caddo Culture Day, a celebration where modern-day Caddo demonstrate traditional artwork, dancing, food, music. What the participants didn't know is that they'd also take part in another Caddo tradition of a kind, Shaho.
Shaho is a Caddo word for the tornado experience. It doesn't mean seeing a tornado, it means experiencing it, the community that develops from a tornado experience.
Williams couldn't believe anyone had survived when he first saw the wreckage, but the calamity also created a community between the survivors. It binds them to each other and to the people who lived among these mounds.
The word Shaho immediately connected me with the past. Because it wouldn't be in their language if it wasn't a thing. But it gave me, and several other people, probably everybody, the word Shaho gives us a thing to hold on to. You know, I don't know how to explain it other than that.
On Saturday, when the site reopened, it was cold and windy, but about 50 people still braved the weather to mark the occasion.
This is a day that I've been waiting for months now. I'd have to sit down and
That's Tony Souther, the site's manager. The ceremony wasn't extravagant. At the request of the Caddo, Souther planted a vine of muscadine grapes and a cedar sapling a few yards from where the museum once stood. People dabbed tissues at their noses and eyes as Souther and Marilyn Threlkeld, a Caddo tribal councilwoman from Oklahoma, watered the tree with local spring water.
Thank you all for coming back. Thank you all for coming and being a part of this.
And we let this tree grow strong in our hearts. Say it's a new beginning here.
A new beginning.
Threlkeld's come to the mounds for years. She was at the site when the tornado hit. To her, being here feels...
that we've come home. More or less our home, that we belong here, part of us. Kind of make us a little stronger in our healing.
The tornado didn't change that. On the day that it happened, rain forced most of the 80 or so people celebrating Caddo Culture Day into the museum, including assistant site manager Rachel Gallant.
I didn't hear anything. My ears didn't pop. The lights went out, a window shattered. Building was gone.
She was knocked over by the building's collapse, but okay. Her husband, Victor Gallant, was not.
I don't think when we first found him we thought that he was alive or that he... I know that by the time Life Flight finally showed up, I think we were close to losing him then.
Victor cracked several vertebrae in his neck, paralyzing him. After waiting hours for help, several people were life flighted from the site, including a woman who later died and Victor. For most of the past 9 months, Rachel's been with him in Houston, where he's receiving treatment at the VA Medical Center. It's been difficult, spending so much time away from their home in Nacogdoches, but they haven't gone through it alone.
It built not just friends, it built family.
It's part of how they've experienced Shaho. Friends raised enough money to help the Golans pay off debts and remodel their home so it's suitable for Victor's wheelchair. Others checked in on the Golan's grown children.
My youngest graduated high school in the middle of this, and we had friends who took her to her graduation and made sure we got to watch it on Skype.
She said she expects her husband to return home in early February, and she's getting back to work at Caddo Mounds, where there's still plenty to do. The Texas legislature allocated $2.5 million to help with the rebuild, including a new museum. And, of course, many of the survivors are still dealing with physical and emotional scars. It's hard, but it's shared.
Shaho, I mean, the tornado, this whole experience has taken us back literally to the earth, to the space. And the rebuilding and recreation of the site we're doing together. And that's how it should be. It's hard. There's a lot of tragedy. There's a lot of going to be challenges going forward. But mostly what I feel is that potential and that strength and gratefulness that I get to be a part of this recreation story.
In Alto, I'm Michael Marks for the Texas Standard.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In recent years, the Department of Justice has relaunched a policy of taking illegal gun possession cases from state court into the federal system. As Matt Richman reports for Guns in America, it's a widely supported policy where concerns about over-incarceration seem to have been forgotten.
First, it was called Operation Triggerlock in 1991. A few years later, Project Exile. Now it's called Project Safe Neighborhoods. Through three decades of gun control debate, one thing has been consistent.
If you were a felon caught with a gun, you will go to jail. 5 years.
That's Charlton Heston, at the time the president of the NRA, testifying in Congress in 1999. Operation Triggerlock started under a Republican president. Project Exile was crafted in Richmond, Virginia, under a Democratic U.S. attorney and a Democratic mayor. And Project Safe Neighborhoods, or PSN, was crafted under George W. Bush. President Trump's first attorney general, Jeff Sessions, hired new assistant U.S. attorneys to handle the additional caseload brought about by a revived PSN.
We are allocating prosecutors in many more cities, including Oakland, California, St. Louis, Toledo, Memphis.
All this has led to a dramatic increase in federal felon in possession prosecutions. In fact, in the last 5 years, there's been a 68% increase in federal charges where gun crimes were the lead charge. Clevelander Charles Miller is getting job training at Cleveland nonprofit Towards Employment.
When you go through the feds, you're hidden in the dark.
Back in 1994, Miller was sent to federal prison for buying a gun as a felon. At the start of his sentence, he was transferred from Michigan to Oklahoma to Pennsylvania.
Handcuffs on my feet, handcuffs on my arm, and then I'm wrapped up in chains.
Miller could have been charged under state law, but by design, federal charges are harsher. The sentences are longer, inmates are usually sent far from home, mandatory minimum sentencing makes parole much less likely. Miller's sentence was 18 months instead of the 5 years that's typical today. But like many black men in cities in the U.S., a drug charge already on his record made owning a gun illegal.
You mean I can't protect my family like the next man? Why? Because I made a mistake? That's why I can't have a gun?
During fiscal year 2018, 7,500 people were sentenced to federal prison for crimes related to owning or selling a firearm. About 70% were black or Hispanic. PSN isn't targeted at particular races, but it does target crime in neighborhoods with high rates of violence.
We really believe that, you know, every kid deserves a chance to walk to school safely.
Justin Herdman is the U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Ohio, which includes Cleveland. His office filed 68% more gun possession cases in 2018 than were filed in the district 5 years ago.
and we have started to see a downward trend in violent crime.
According to Herdman, there's been about a 10% drop in murders. PSN has been criticized because it targets individual gun owners, a low-level crime typically handled in state court. But, says Herdman, that's the most realistic way to get guns off the street.
The reality is the place that you're most likely to see gun and perpetrator is going to be at that street-level interaction with a patrol officer.
David Patton of the Federal Public Defender's Office in Manhattan argues that is bound to lead to a program targeting racial minorities.
We have made a policy decision in the criminal justice system that poor people of color can't possess guns. When you look at who's prohibited from possessing firearms, that's largely who it is.
In Cleveland, PSN focuses on moving cases from two largely poor black police districts from state to federal court. Patton also criticizes the use of longer sentences as a deterrent.
It really addresses a factor that is shown to be least likely to impact crime rates, and that is the severity of the sentence.
According to Patton, more effective deterrents are social norms that discourage criminal activity and convince people of a quick arrest. Charles Miller has put guns and drugs behind him after years in and out of prison. But he still sees an injustice in the way gun possession laws are applied.
A rich man can go and say to the government, I'll pay whatever you need and let me have 1,000 guns. And it's no problem because he doesn't have that felony.
For Guns in America, I'm Matt Richman.
Guns in America and our partners at KERA North Texas are spending 2 years reporting on the role of guns in American life. You can learn more at gunsandamerica.org.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
When we conceived the Texas Standard, we wanted to carve out a space where listeners could express themselves any way they wanted. We knew that every Texan had a story, but we also knew some of those stories were maybe too dangerous or too shameful or too hurtful to be told openly. So we created The Whole Truth, a place where you can speak your truth without speaking your name.
I am a liar. I have never hog-tied a dust devil in the yellow Llano Seco. I've never caught a thunderstorm in a mason jar in the Big Ben. Never rode for 8 seconds the Marfa lights or shoot down a bright blinking star with a Apache bow on the Rio Grande. I've never stolen Willie's boots or De La Rosa's accordion or Stevie's guitar or Selena's voice. I have lied about outracing Gregorio Cortez on a dusty strip near Manor. Lied about shooting Sam Bass in the back of a Round Rock HEB. That time I fished off the coast of South Padre with Cabeza de Vaca never happened. The time I rode a thin painted horse alongside Canaja on the Ocla, Texas border was obviously a lie. The only truth I have, the grit between teeth while twisting baling wire around a twisted mesquite post to hold a taut strand of barbed wire, the heavy iron scent of blood dripping from a gash on your cheek where a wrench flew out your hand from a diesel motor, rubbing sore eyes after 12 hours in the cold glow of a computer spying for flaws in your coding. Taste of salt from sweat while you're bent over a hot stainless steel sink full of pots and pans from the lunch rush peak between suds. Toil is the truth of Texas, so I lied to escape, and that is the whole truth.
So, what's your story? Got a secret? If you're ready to talk, email us, TexasStandard@KUT.org.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. Tonight, top Democratic candidates take the stage in what will be their last meeting before February 3rd, that date, of course, marking the Democratic Iowa caucuses. Those caucuses, of course, believed to be a kind of bellwether for how candidates will do in other contests, giving voters in the nation's 31st most populous state an outsized influence over predictions, mainly just because the Hawkeye state is the first state chronologically to determine which candidates it's going to select. But perhaps, hear us out here, perhaps Texas should be the state to kick off primary voting. Dan Solomon is making this very case in his latest for Texas Monthly, and he joins us now. Dan, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Always good to be here.
So this appeal of yours is predicated on the idea that Iowa should not be the first primary state. What's wrong with the Iowa caucuses as you see it?
Well, there are a few things. One of the main ones is that Iowa is not really a representative state when it comes to, looking at the demographics of the rest of the country. It's a lot more rural than the rest of the country. It's a lot whiter than America. It's older. And so giving Iowa such outsized influence means that, you've got a non-representative group that's sort of shaping the narratives around who's going to be president.
But state pride aside, don't we always talk about how Texas is unique? I mean, is Texas really more representative of the body politic in the United States as a whole?
Well, yeah, the answer is absolutely it is. We are a diverse state in terms of our geography and, how where people are distributed. We've got rural areas, we've got coastal areas, we've got, some of the largest cities in the country, we've got small towns, we've got suburbs. Mm-hmm. So in that way, we are demographically, we're more diverse than the rest of the country, but in ways that reflect where the country is headed. So, I think that in 2020, if you're a much whiter state than the rest of the country, then you're not really representing the future. But here, we have a larger Latino population that, does reflect what changes are happening demographically to the country. And, those are people whose voices have been kind of minimized in politics over the years. And so giving them a larger voice would only be a good thing.
Dan, I think somebody listening to you in New York City, for example, might say, you're telling me that Texas is a diverse state? we've been seen as this last bastion of conservatism for many, many years. Why not California or Florida, or for that matter, Maryland, which calls itself Little America?
Well, I think that, in New York and in California, those are certainly people who already have quite a large voice when it comes to determining the shape of American politics. Certainly there's no lack of people in New York City who get to determine what the rest of us hear about and, end up thinking about in terms of our politics. The same is true in the biggest cities in California. Florida would be an interesting choice, but Florida is already such a such an important state in our politics because it's often the state that, if you win Florida, you win the election. If you lose Florida, you lose the election. Mm-hmm. So if Florida were the first primary state, effectively Florida would set the agenda. We would just kind of let Florida decide who the president was. And I think that maybe we ought to look at other states for that. When it comes to someone like Maryland or one of the smaller states, one thing that I found as I was working on this is that the focus on Iowa really gives a lot of time to people in Iowa, maybe more than anybody needs. You know, right now, everybody in Iowa gets to have every candidate over in their living room. They get to watch them eat a corn dog at the state fair. You get a lot of really direct one-on-one time with candidates, mm-hmm. which is great if you live there. But if you don't live there, then, you know, you're missing out on sort of how the campaign is playing out. Whereas Texas, because we're enormous, people would have to travel the state. They would have to do media. They would have to learn to communicate with the voters in a primary state the uh-huh. same way that they have to communicate with the country at large. So if you're looking for one state to start with, I think that Texas actually does make the most sense. I kind of, when I conceived this, I was kind of thinking about it as a, not exactly a joke, but like, okay, well, could I poke holes in this argument? And mm-hmm. the more I thought about it, the more sense it really made to me.
Dan Solomon is a writer for Texas Monthly. We'll have a link to his latest at texasstandard.org. Dan, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. All right, Wells Dunbar is here. He has been monitoring the talk of Texas on this Tuesday, and what do you see?
Hey, well, folks are chiming in about that story we just heard, this fun story about what if Texas jumped the queue in the primaries come presidential mm-hmm. election season. Via Twitter, Rachel Zock says, makes more sense for a large, diverse electorate to go first. I've always hated that Iowa gets to narrow the field before I get a vote. And that is an interesting concept to think about there.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of Iowa and fields narrowing, there is a presidential debate tonight, the last before those Iowa primaries. And on that narrow debate field, we're going to see some fireworks probably, as we talked about earlier, a he said, she said situation thwarting the friendship between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. It's certain to come up during tonight. The messy story played out all day yesterday. Anonymous Warren staffers told CNN that during an otherwise cordial conversation in 2018, Sanders told Warren that a woman couldn't win the presidency. Sanders responded with a forceful denial, saying that while he thought Trump would attack everything about the 2020 nominee, including potentially her gender, he never said that a woman couldn't win. Then Warren ultimately confirmed the anonymous allegations, writing of the meeting, quote, among the topics that came up was what would happen if Democrats nominated a female candidate. I thought a woman could win. He disagreed. Sanders continuing to dispute that characterization of the conversation. Mm. Lots of talk about this one online, as you might expect,
yeah.
including Twitter. Their listener, Eclecticity, he tweets us that often there's a line between misogyny and pragmatism. Clinton was victimized by many factors, Hillary Clinton there, including some she had control of, and misogyny was a large factor. The question on the table, did Bernie say it? I'd bet he did, if only to reduce the field. Meanwhile, some doubters out there as well. Peter Moore, he says, that's a strange thing to say, especially since a woman already won the presidency in terms of the popular vote. That would be a one Hillary Clinton there, leading by some 3 million votes, I believe, in the popular vote. Peter says, I tend to believe Bernie on this one. Kay Van Oort says, oh, please, we have more important issues to worry about. And many other people talking about, well, what is this going to, how is this going to play out? Could this potentially benefit someone else, like a Joe Biden, seeing the two, I guess, most left Democratic contenders.
Yeah, that's interesting. Like interesting that you would say that, because the New York Times is putting it this way, the headline, mm-hmm. Mom and Dad are fighting. Left-wing Democrats lament Sanders-Warren rift. I my question, I guess, mm-hmm. and I haven't seen the, maybe someone knows this and yeah. I've just missed it, but is he being accused of actually using those words?
That is, and that's the sort of
or is
issue
it like an implication.
No, he's being accused of saying that directly, although there are lots of sort of caveats. You know, you could sort of, you know, just looking back at that characterization from Warren about characterizing this as a disagreement. Is this, there's a little bit of a gray area here, but it'll probably come up tonight. We'll have a video of the debate on our Facebook page tonight, so folks can check it out. And I'm sure we'll have some fresh thoughts about this in our weekly newsletter, which goes out Wednesday morning.
Yes.
Folks
it does.
Can sign up at texasstandard.org.
Yeah.
Good idea there.
I think the debate begins at about 8 o'clock Texas Standard Time. If you're in El Paso, that would be around 7 o'clock, of course. We're out of time for the big broadcast here, but we're going to be back same time tomorrow, same station. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David, wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on. Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.